University Forum is a presentation of Nebraska Wesleyan University, which brings speakers and performers to the campus throughout the semester to lecture on a variety of topics. The opinions expressed by the speakers do not necessarily represent the opinions of Nebraska Wesleyan University or of this station. Today, University Forum presents John R. Turk, Associate Professor of Music at the Dana School of Music at Youngstown State University. His lecture is entitled Self-Expression, the Tuba, a Museum Piece Comes to Life Just in Time. In addition to teaching tuba and euphonium at Youngstown State, Turk directs the University New Music Ensemble and teaches one of the nation's first classes in the history of rock music. He is a solo tubist with the Youngstown Symphony Orchestra and a member of the Blossom Music Festival Band. He made his New York debut in 1975 as a soloist at Carnegie Hall, and has toured the country as a clinician lecturer for several professional music associations.
I'm pleased to introduce to you our forum speaker for today, Mr. John Turk. Mr. Turk graduated in 1967 from Baldwin Wallace College, which is a Methodist liberal arts institution in Berea, Ohio, that has a history of turning out many fine instrumental music majors. Following graduation, Mr. Turk served as a tuba soloist with the United States Army Band in Washington, D.C., then went on to graduate school at Indiana University, and then to his present position at Youngstown University, where he's been for the past 15 years. He's a member of the Youngstown Symphony Orchestra and the Blossom Festival Band. He's performed tuba solos all over the country, including a recital at Carnegie Hall in 1977. Recently, he just finished a recording of tuba solos on Vox Records. Please join me in welcoming Mr. John Turk.
Good morning. I'm very happy to be here. I've never been to Nebraska before. Dr. Dragala kept telling me that it's not very cold here. I don't know what the point you're waiting for. As I'm sure for many of you, this is sort of a first close encounter with a tuba. I left a tuba here on stage, so you know you're in the right place, and so it would warm up the room temperature, which is very important for tubas. Since it's probably the first time you've ever been this close to a tuba player or a tuba, I'd like to start with some music. I'd like to play the first movement, the Allemann music from the Sonata in A minor by Johann Sebastian Bach. The Thank you very much. Every time you play in a new hall, it's different. You know, you point your bell over this way, and it doesn't sound right. You point it over that way, and it doesn't sound right. And after a while, you realize it doesn't make it. It's probably me. One of the things that Dr. Peabody sent me when we communicated about today's program was a list of the people who were doing faculty forums for this fall, 86. And I want to tell you, I mean, I was appalled. You know, I mean, there were a lot of fairly big-name people there, a lot of very interesting topics, I mean, SDI and stuff like that. I wish I could have heard some of them. And then I see down at the bottom my name. Talking about Tupac, I felt a little bit like Andy Rooney, you know. He's the guy that comes on 60 Minutes after 50 minutes of relatively hardcore, heavy-duty reporting about relatively important things, and he comes on right at the very end, and for 10 minutes, or maybe 5 minutes, he talks very seriously about something of marginal importance, you know, like how come they put so much cotton in bottles of aspirin and stuff like that. Actually, if the truth be known, it's really kind of improbable that I would be doing anything like this at all in the first place. See, my dad was, as they say, real high up in one of this country's major corporations. You know, if I told you the name of the corporation, you'd say, oh, yeah, I've heard it. As a matter of fact, he was vice president. He's retired now. They work with chemicals, you know. My mother was a physician. That's kind of remarkable for a woman, you know, 40 years ago to be a physician. In addition to that, she had kind of gotten rid of the family stigma of all the daughters becoming educators. She'd escaped from it. So, although they both liked music, my dad had a record collection and my mother sang in the church choir, they had rather low opinion of the career or the profession of music. In addition, they had a rather low opinion of the career of educator. I mean, they thought education was important, but it was something that somebody else did, you know. So when I told them sometime during my senior year in high school that I was going to become a tuba player and a teacher, it was met with considerable opposition, as you can imagine. There was only one thing that made my decision for me and one thing that gave me the courage to face this incredible opposition, and that was the advice that was given to me by one teacher. I'll never forget what she said, and I'd like to share it with you this morning. She said, look, you're trying to decide whether to go into music, right? First of all, talent. Talent's sort of important, but it's not that important. You can get by in music without very much talent. We all know people that do. Industry, you know, that thing where you give up time and you practice hour after hour and you sacrifice for your career, that's important too. But again, that's marginally important because I know a lot of people who practice a lot and just don't seem to get any better. What it really boils down to is this. It boils down to communication and expression. You have to feel as though you have something inside of you to communicate. And you must feel that music is the one best avenue, the one best way for you to get that communication out to other people. Now, everybody has their own thing. Some people paint. You know, some people speak. Some people act. Some people dance. And some people perform music. If you feel that performing music is your best way to communicate, and if you can convince other people that you're communicating to them through music and that you have something to say, then music is for you. I think that's pretty good advice, and not just for musicians, but for just about anybody. Now, as I'm sure a lot of you already know, the piece that I just played by Johann Sebastian Bach was not written for the tuba at all. Bach never heard of the tuba. If he had, who knows? Probably nothing. I stole it, okay? It's a piece for flute, as some of you may already know. My wife is a flute player, and when I practice that at home, I get the dirtiest looks you can imagine. Tuba players are very good at stealing other people's music. We use the non-criminal term transcriber. It sounds better somehow or other. We've been doing it for years. The reason we do it is because the tuba is a very new instrument. We can almost point to an exact date when the tuba was invented. Very few instruments besides the saxophone can do that. It was built first in about 1850, about 120, 130 years ago. The trumpet goes all the way back past King Tut. The trombone goes way past the Middle Ages. Even the French horn looks old, but it isn't quite as old as it looks. But it certainly goes back. I mean, Bach was writing wonderful things for the French horn. The tuba is invented in 1850. It is invented almost exactly the way you see it today. If a tuba player from 1850 came back and took a look at my tuba, it would look exactly like the tuba that he plays, except for one thing. These little black, I'm sure you can see this real well in the background, these little black pieces right here used to be cork. Now they're a special kind of rubber that's a little bit harder that makes them bounce a little bit more. Other than that, it's a museum piece. Unfortunately for the tuba, there was good news and bad news. The good news was that composers went ahead and started to use it right away. It became a standard member of the symphony orchestra and a standard member of the military band. That's the good news. The bad news was that it was automatically and almost universally relegated to a position in the back row. It had its own role, its own function, and that's where it stayed. There were composers who recognized the melodic possibilities of the instrument, Strauss and Wagner, to mention a couple. But they did not have the courage to write solos for the instrument. We did not really worry about this transcription thing until about 1950. I mean, so few tuba players were doing it. It really hardly seemed to matter, you know, if you borrowed a French horn piece, or if you borrowed a trombone piece, or if you borrowed a flute piece. In about 1950, we ran into a big problem, and that's this. Most of the tuba playing jobs had evaporated. The concert band, the professional concert band, was the heyday of the professional concert band, was a thing of the past. Popular music in the United States had turned to rock and roll. No place for the tuba whatsoever. So if you wanted to make a living concentrating on the tuba, you had only one choice, and that was to go into music education and concentrate on the tuba. In the 1950s, we had a tremendous influx in colleges like this one of people who majored on the tuba. Well, there's nothing wrong with that as far as I mean. Why shouldn't the tuba player be a band director? You know? Why shouldn't the percussionist be a band director? The only problem came when it came time for the senior recital. Senior recital, you see, is the thing that's given toward the end of the senior year where your teacher assigns you or you pick two or three pieces to demonstrate your prowess on the instrument to get a grade, and you play the recital. Well, now here's the tuba. By 1960, there were two pieces of music written for the tuba. Two pieces, some repertoire, right? Luckily, the 1960s happened just at the right time, and that's what I would like to talk about, the 1960s. By 1960, we had a concerto by Ralph Vaughan Williams, relatively well-known English composer. Very few people actually had the music, and the ones that did realize that it was not his best piece by any means. It has a few strong points, but a lot more weak points. And there was also a sonata written by Paul Hindemith for tuba and piano. It's a very typical Hindemith sonata. The piano part is fiendishly difficult. The tuba part is somewhat difficult, very uncompromising. For a long time, people couldn't even tell when you were playing the right notes in the piece, you know. Now, we have enough recordings, and we studied enough. And I know the piece to be a really fine piece of music. I just recently recorded it, seemed like a week ago, just last Monday, the first professional recording I'd ever made of it. And it's a really fine piece of music. But before 1960, imagine that, just two pieces in the repertoire. Something happened in the 1960s, a tremendous explosion occurred. Before we talk about the explosion, I'd like to play you one of the fine pieces of music written for the tuba during the 1960s. When I talk about the 1960s, I don't really mean 1960 to 1970. As I tell my rock and roll class, the 1960s really go from about 1963 to about 1975. That is, the upheaval in music does not quite correspond to the upheaval in society and politics, you know, and that sort of thing. This piece is written in 1972 by William Penn. It's called Three Essays for Unaccompanied Tuba. It's no piano, it's tuba all by itself. First one is Elegy, the second one is Interlude, and the third one is Postlude. You can tell just by looking at the music that we're in trouble here. I mean, it opens up like this, so...
That's all. Thank you. Now, what is it exactly that happened in the 1960s to music and to tuba players? There's a concept that's well known among people who teach music appreciation class. It's rather simplistic. If you want to know the truth, it's a big lie. But it's a good way to introduce people to good music, at least at the beginning level. It goes something like this. All Western music can be divided into three basic types. You have folk music, you have pop music, and you have art music. Well, right away there's a problem with that because folk music. I mean, folk music is really pop music that's just sort of had its day and kind of kept alive, you know, by nostalgia. You know what I mean? That's a simplistic way to look at it, but it's the truth. Now, pop music. You know, I feel like that's Supreme Court justice talking about pornography. You know it when I see it, but I can't define it. Well, I know pop music when I hear it, but I'm not sure I can define it. And art music, well, that seems fairly clear-cut and everything. And yet, you know, the operas of Verdi were very popular. They were considered pop music when they were first written. Now we consider them high art. Where do you put something like, even in the 20th century, you know, where do you put West Side Story? I mean, is that pop music or is it art music? You know, where exactly do you put it? What happened in the 1960s, and this is not the first time it happened, but it certainly is the most dramatic occurrence spawned by several things. One, the mass media. One, the so-called counterculture that grew around the Vietnam conflict, in which I was an inactive participant. That was this. All of a sudden, for about 5 years there, all three types of music, pop and art, in particular, seemed to merge together. 1967, 68, 69, 67, 68 had major artistic contributions by the Beatles, Frank Zappa's group called the Mothers of Invention, by the Doors, by the Jefferson Airplane, by Velvet Underground, the list goes on and on. These are all rock and roll groups borrowing very heavily from classic, so-called classical composers. the same time, you had composers like Luciano Berio writing a piece called Symphonia that borrows very heavily on rock and roll music. Peter Maxwell Davies' piece called Songs for a Mad King borrows very heavily on rock and roll music. The piece by Hans Werner Henze called Essay Over on Pigs, pigs being cops, you know, borrows very heavily on rock and roll. For a time there, it almost seemed as though the two were going to merge. And I think the real crux of it, I think the real bottom line, is something that I call the liberation of sound. That is, all of a sudden, because of the interaction, mostly because of what rock and roll bands were doing, but also the interaction of classical composers, any sound that you could use, any sound that an instrument could produce, could now be used legitimately as a source of musical expression. Now, I said this instrument is a museum piece that had been around for a long time. For at least the last 100 years, almost the entire lifetime of the tuba, most composers and most listeners recognize certain sounds that were produced on instruments as being musical sounds that you could use. Other sounds that you could produce were used simply as jokes or for parties, you know, something like that. 1960s inherited and matured the groundwork laid by people like John Cage, Charles Ives, and Edgar Varèse. You know, John Cage. You know, John Cage even said that silence is important. Some of you may know he wrote a piece that's all silence. It's called 4 minutes and 33 seconds. All rests. You can play it on any instrument. And, I mean, it's been the butt of thousands of jokes about the piece over the years. In all fairness to John Cage, you really should say that the piece was really almost as much to be thought about, you know, as to actually be performed. Have you heard those recorded sounds of humpback whales, the sounds they use in Star Trek IV? You know? Those were first made commercially available in the 1960s. The technology was available before then, but the military had it, you know, and wouldn't give it to the general public. When the first recording, there were two recordings that came out, one, the famous one called Songs of the Humpback Whale, and these were recorded sounds of the songs that humpback whales sing. It had a tremendous effect on composers. Pink Floyd, the rock group Pink Floyd, composes a piece that lasts an entire side of the record that is based on, it's called Echoes, that is based on the songs of the humpback whale. You have composers like George Crumb, Alan Povanus, the list goes on and on, inspired by those kinds of sounds. The piece that I just played by William Penn, the sounds at the very end were inspired by one particular whale sound that the composer heard and tried to emulate on the tuba. Imagine if those if that recording had been made available in 1850. What would composers have thought? Come on, I mean, this is noise, right? I mean, this is not musical sound. We use it as a joke or something. In the 1960s, the liberation of sound makes it possible for composers to actually use those sounds, be inspired by those sounds, and we get at least one piece by William Penn based on that. Oh, by the way, before I forget, the 1960s are just like any other time. 90% of the music that was written was garbage. 90% was headed for the trash heap. In 1850, 90% was headed for the trash heap, too. But that still leaves 10%. So now here comes this army of tuba players. Their ranks swelled, you know, by the post-war baby boom. The need for recital literature spawned by the Bachelor of Music Education degree. They have no literature at all. They have no glorious history. They will play anything. They have no built-in prejudices. They will play anything. And composers will respond. Six-piece composers will respond. All of a sudden, we have thousands of pieces written for the tuba. Tuba players will play anything. I played pieces without my shoes on. I played pieces with electronics attached to the instrument. I've taken the instrument apart. I've done everything you can possibly imagine. I just got a piece last week by a composer. It's a 20-minute piece, a theater piece for tuba alone. The first half, he asks you to play without your shirt on. Well, you know, 20 years ago I would have done it, you know, and I'm not anymore. And I understand why he's doing it. I understand what the piece is all about, but, you know, I have a couple of female students, you know, that have shown some interest in the piece, but we're not going to do that anymore. But out of that big sea of weird, strange pieces will come 10% worth of really fine pieces of music. I'd like to sidestep just for a second the usual questions you get after you play a piece like that. People say, well, you know what they are anyway. People say, come on, is that really music? Or, you just made that up, right? You actually bought that? And I would like to skip to another question that is asked sometimes that means a little bit more to me, is a little more interesting to me as an educator, and that is, people say, okay, look, I understand this stuff about liberation of sound. I mean, you can use any sound you want, and the tuba's been a prisoner of its museum and all that kind of stuff. So you're playing all kinds of weird sounds, so we understand all that, and if you want to do it, you go right ahead. But you said 90% of the stuff was headed for the trash heap. That leaves 10% that's supposed to be good, worthwhile literature. How do you tell the 10%? And how do you know what's good and what's not good? Well, as a listener, I can't always tell. I don't think anybody can always tell as a listener. You know, they say that great music, the stuff that's really good, will kind of float to the top. It will survive the test of time. Even that's not 100% true. I mean, a lot of what we play today is based on prejudices and stuff like that. So how do you tell? As a listener, it's tough for me. As a performer, I have a much easier time. Something that I heard once, I can't remember who said it, it's not original with me by any means. I remember the guy said, look, a really great piece of music, a really fine piece of music, is a piece of music that cannot be given one definitive performance. There's no such thing as one person singing The Erl King by Schubert and getting everything out of that song that you can possibly get out of it. There's more in that song than any one person can handle. A great piece of music like Don Giovanni by Mozart, you can hear 20 different performances, each one different, each one viable, each one getting a little something else out of the piece. That's one of the ways that I, as a performer, tell a great piece of music. The piece that I played by Bach at the beginning of the hour is a piece like that. What do I try to get out of it? I try to get the underlying feeling of power behind the piece. Even in the quieter places, there's always this feeling of kind of quiet energy, uneasy restlessness. I think the tuba captures that trailer, maybe even better than the flute. Well, I apologize to any flute players that may be here. And I understand that the old flute that it was originally written for actually plays the piece a little bit better than the modern flute. I mean, that's what the experts say. I'd like to play another piece from the 60s, written in that magic year 1967, the so-called Summer of Love, when the Sgt. Pepper's album and the Rolling Stones' Satanic Majesty album came out. This piece is called Encounters 2 by William Craft. I like to put it alongside the Bach piece because it also has that same kind of hidden, uneasy energy. It's a nasty little piece is what it is. You want to fasten your seatbelts for this one. It also is related to the Bach piece in that the basic thematic material is B, A, C, B flat, or in German musical terms, B, A, C, H, or it's Bach's name spelled in music. That's been done by many composers, including Bach himself. This is just one of the more recent uses of the Bach theme. I won't say any more about it. Let's play it for you. Thank you. To close this morning by playing for you the Rag for Solo Tuba by Arthur Crackenfold. Thank you.
Today, University Forum has presented John R. Turk, Associate Professor of Music at the Dana School of Music at Youngstown State University. His lecture was entitled Self-Expression, the Tuba, a Museum Piece Comes to Life Just in Time. This has been University Forum, a presentation of Nebraska Wesleyan University. Nebraska Wesleyan is a private, undergraduate liberal arts college located in Lincoln, Nebraska. Approximately 1,300 students are enrolled in more than 40 major programs.